The following Bible study is presented by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Tonight we will continue in the book of Hosea and cover the next two chapters. And two chapters per study seems to be comfortable, so we will continue this pattern throughout the series of the book of Hosea. As a reminder, while we begin, Hosea preached during the time of the divided kingdom, and he was a prophet sent to the house of Israel, sent to confront their idolatry and to warn them of impending doom because of what was truly spiritual adultery. But this prophet was also sent to relate an enduring message to the future of people of God down through the ages and to express to them how God feels about putting values that are contrary to him in place of or above the commandments, statutes, and laws that he had designed. And as a result of their iniquity, the northern kingdom was conquered by Assyria in 722 BC. The commentaries all believe that Hosea lived to see the invasion of the northern kingdom and the destruction of the house of Israel. And last time we had discussed some of the acted oracles of Hosea's marriage to a harlot and the birth of three children by his wife, this woman by the name of Gomer. An enacted oracle is God-given instructions of actions that a prophet is instructed to carry out as to relate a message from God. So the first acted oracle we saw of Hosea represented the fact that Israel had committed adultery by playing the harlot with false gods. And then Hosea's wife had children, and the names of these children also related a message from God, as discussed in that study. And so we see the first child was named Jezreel, meaning that God will sow. And this was a name first given to a fertile area where King Ahab and Jezebel, who was a priestess of Baal, had lived. These two individuals were responsible for extreme wickedness in Israel, as documented in the book of Kings, chapter 16 and 20, or 16 through 20. However, although Jezreel may have sown idolatry in that land, the name Jezreel of Hosea's child may refer to King Jehu, who was raised up to cultivate a work, as God instructed him to remove the worship of Baal. But Jehu did not entirely complete this task, and he was not entirely faithful. And so his work did not save Israel from destruction, and it only delayed their fall for a period of time. And so it could be that Jezreel stood for God will sow destruction. So the second child's name was Luhakama, and it's a name meaning not pitied. And this name symbolizes the fact that Israel had many chances to repent. And though God is merciful, his mercy is not continuous when wickedness does not cease. And so he would not pity the house of Israel any longer. And then the third child born of Gomer represented the fact that Israel was not God's people any longer. And it's likely, in fact, that Hosea was not even the father of this third child, and that Gomer again played the harlot, as she was known to do in the past. And so in the third chapter this evening, if you don't have it open already, go ahead and open up to Hosea 3. In this third chapter, we're going to begin with another acted oracle of this prophet who was sent to the house of Israel. Hosea chapter 3 and in verse 1. Then the Eternal said to me, go again and love a woman who is loved by a lover and is committing adultery, just like the love of the Eternal for the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love the raisin cakes of the pagans. Hosea was told to go and take for himself another woman to wife who was an adulteress. And this sent a message from God that he had taken for himself a people who were committing spiritual adultery by their idolatry. But not just the worship of idols. You see, the false doctrine that they adopted and that they put in place of God's commandments, it had caused their entire society to become corrupt. And so Israel had a long history of waxing and waning in their faith, as stated in the first study. Israel fell to the worship of false gods even when they were in Egypt. In Joshua 24 and verse 14, after they went into the promised land, "Now, therefore, fear the Eternal and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt, and instead serve the Eternal." And so we see that the people of Israel were worshiping false gods in Egypt before God had saved them and brought them out of bondage. Now, the New King James version of the scripture says that the children of Israel loved the raisin cakes of the pagans. And this was speaking of a form of bread that pagans would prepare in honor of Ashtoreth and in honor of the Baals. Now, the King James translation says Aisha Anab means flagons of wine instead of raisin cakes. And so it could be that this is what the author intended, because Ayashash means something closely pressed together, like smashing of grapes in order to make wine. And of course, this translation would be fitting, considering the representation found in the scriptures of ungodly individuals becoming drunk on false doctrine. Still, it is possible that God was referencing the pressing together of the grape by the implosion that takes place when the grapes dry out and form raisins, which these raisins were then used religiously by making raisin bread and offering this bread to false gods. In Hosea 3 and verse 2, after receiving these instructions, it says, "So Hosea, I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and 1 1/2 omers of barley." And so this second woman Hosea was told to take for his own, she was in the midst of fulfilling a commitment of servitude, which is why he had to purchase her. And likely the servitude was a result of her adultery. And so was Israel in the midst of servitude before God brought them out of bondage from the land of Egypt. And then they were cleansed after being brought out. But eventually they went and played the harlot again and again. Now, verse 2 also indicates that Hosea had purchased this woman for 15 shekels of silver. And so she was obviously the property of someone else, which indicates that she was indebted to servitude before he had purchased her. And the reason for her indebtedness is not known. It's likely related to circumstances of ill behavior, such as adultery. But the reason I bring this out is Exodus 21 and verse 32 indicates that a person who had sold themselves into slavery was to be valued at 30 shekels of silver. And so here we see Hosea seems to have gotten a bargain, and the low price, I think, that he paid for her indicates that she was a woman of poor reputation. In other words, not much value as a servant, possibly not a good worker, and so only rendered as half the going rate. So Hosea purchased this woman, and he brought her out of servitude, and then he gave her strict instructions to follow. In verse 3, "And I said to her, you shall stay with me many days, and you shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So too I will be toward you." The adulterous woman was told to come and live with Hosea for a period of time and to not have sexual relations with any man, not even with Hosea. And Hosea, it says, would not have relations with any woman, not even with his wife Gomer. So basically, this adulterous woman, she would have a roof over her head, but she would be living much like a widow. And this was another acted oracle relating several things. You see, God brought Israel out of Egypt, where they were indentured to servitude because of their idolatry. And they were a people not much valued very much in the land of Egypt. But Israel's faithfulness to God after being brought out, it was relatively short-lived. They waxed and waned in their faith to God. And so as a result, God would eventually divorce them, and they would remain without a spiritual husband for thousands of years. Jeremiah later wrote in chapter 3 and verse 8, that he saw that for all the causes for which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, and God put her away and had given her a certificate of divorce. And so it would be that the northern tribes would fall and be taken away in bondage, and they would abide many days without God as their husband. And verse 4, For the children of Israel shall abide many days without king, or prince, without sacrifice, or sacred pillar, without ephod, or teraphim. Hosea prophesied that the time would come that all of Israel would be put away. There would be no king, no prince for them. And this is speaking to either one of the divided kingdoms, actually. There would be no daily, weekly, or annual sacrifices, no temple for them to worship in any longer, no ephod, referring to the priesthood, and a teraphim, which is a sacred pillar not to be found within their borders. And this could be referencing graven images as well, or perhaps family idols. In other words, Israel would be cut off from God, and they would be unable even to take their idols with them, ransacked, raped, pillaged, if you will. And so the house of Israel would be dissolved as a nation, and the survivors would be scattered throughout the world. And this took place. And then, a century later, the same would happen to the house of Judah. In Jeremiah 3 and verse 8, it says, "Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but went and played the harlot also." This acted oracle portrays Israel being cut off from both God and even their false gods while in captivity. And the woman Hosea purchased was married previously, but now divorced and put away. She was given a period of time alone as a form of purification before Hosea would have her. And Israel's time cut off from God, I think, may also represent a type of purification that needs to take place before God will take Israel to himself again. And during this period of time, God would have nothing to do with her, just as Hosea had no relations with this adulterous woman. And this is currently taking place right now, before Christ returns and before God brings Israel back to the promised land. In addition, Amos 8 and verse 11 prophesies of a time where there will be a famine of the word of God. Another destruction and captivity for Jacob's descendants is coming, and at that time, the word of God will not be heard by those who have the commandments of God, but are not worthy to escape. And so these people must prove themselves in the tribulation, as Revelation in chapter 3 indicates. They must be tried in the fire, and likely martyred if they hope to be chosen. And so this could be another representation of there being no ephod or sacred pillar. But the putting away of Israel will not be permanent. The next verse indicates that the lost tribes of Israel and also the house of Judah, they will be brought back to their land and to their God again. In verse 5, it says, "Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Eternal their God and David their king, and they shall fear the Eternal and his goodness in the latter days." These latter days reference the second Exodus to occur after Christ returns, when God will gather the descendants of Israel from the nations around the world. Most of these people don't even know who they are, where their heritage came from at this time. And so God will bring them back to the promised land, where they will again become his people, and he will be their God. And we see that chapter 3 of Hosea, it's like a snapshot of what God was going to do at that time, and also what he is doing right now, and what will come in the future. And so this was primarily addressed to the house of Israel, but we see that it includes the house of Judah, and the oracles that Hosea was told to do, it includes also the church of God, by pointing to the time of Jacob's trouble, persecution of the remnant who have the commandments of God, and their future redemption when Christ returns. The next chapter continues bringing charges against Israel, but as we read the first few verses here in chapter 4, we see that there is an inclusion of other people, other nations and tongues. And verses 1 through 3, "Hear the word of the Eternal, you children of Israel. For the Eternal brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying, killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed upon bloodshed. And therefore the land will mourn, and everyone who dwells there will waste away, with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea will be taken away. The behaviors of Israel became vastly corrupt and wicked. And the vast majority of people on the earth are no different today. Why, people swear, they lie, they steal, they fornicate, they commit adultery, they commit spiritual harlotry on a daily basis. And at that time, there was bloodshed upon bloodshed. This is an expression meaning sin upon sin, one sin after another, continuous. And just as God brought destruction to Israel for their blatant and continual sins, he will also bring devastation to the entire earth. And verse 3 is indicative of a wider application of God's wrath, stating that the land will mourn. Everyone who dwells there will waste away, with the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea, it states. And so the book of Revelation in chapters 6 through 9 and also chapter 16, these chapters speak of billions perishing, even larger numbers suffering the effects of miraculous disasters of war and famine and disease. But the end time events will not only affect people. The beasts of the field, the green grass, the birds of the air, the trees, and the fish will also be affected by the tribulation. And this is going to be a result of man's sins. One third of all aquatic creatures, the prophecy state, will die during the plagues. And eventually everything in the oceans will die, just as Hosea prophesied. Even the fish of the sea will be taken away. A type of the coming catastrophic events occurred in Israel on a much smaller scale. God foretold what would happen to those who rejected his moral law, and it came to pass. And secular history even documents their demise in the Assyrian and Babylonian tablets. And this is evidence of a coming tribulation because of the growing and continual wickedness of men. So the house of Israel came to resemble the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah with its idol worship, its murder, and no sexual boundaries. And it's much the same throughout the world today, particularly in Western and so-called free or democratic nations such as America. Cities like New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and New Orleans and Hollywood, and even in many smaller cities around the world, we see homosexuality is commonplace and spiritual harlotry is rampant. Just about any kind of God a person wants to worship is promoted today, except for Christianity is becoming more and more ridiculed and mocked. Movies are more graphic and more anti-moral and anti-family values than ever. Nearly every sick or twisted lifestyle is considered equal to or even better than Christianity. Because evil today is just a matter of perspective to most people. As I've heard said, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Hosea 4 and verse 4. Now let no man contend or rebuke one another, for your people are like those who contend with the priest. And the reference to a priest is a true priest who has an understanding of the law, and they would contend with this priest because, you know, you can't tell anyone they're wrong, even if the correction is just. And it sounds much like the world today, because the moral compass of most is out of whack. It's a you can't tell me what to do type of attitude. People have abandoned good judgment, and they rebel against the law because they've abandoned God. They argue and they persecute with those individuals that teach God's law. Verse 5, therefore you shall stumble in the day, and the prophet also shall stumble with you in the night, and I will destroy your mother. So it says they will stumble in the day because of this, and the reason is because they love darkness rather than light. John 3:19. They prefer evil over good, and this will cause them to fall in their obscurity. And the prophet that shall stumble, it says, it's not talking about a true prophet sent by God, but a false prophet or false prophets who teach tolerance of wickedness and diversity of sexuality, but they cannot lead the way because their way is a shroud of iniquity, doesn't have good footing. Destroying their mother refers to the gods and the ideals that the people had come to rely on to provide for them, to provide nourishment and guidance for them like a true mother should. But instead of milk, they were drinking poison, just like people are drinking today, a toxic mixture of false doctrine. Verse 6, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will also reject you from being a priest before me. Because you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children." So the lack of true knowledge among the nation, this was not accidental. It's not like they just forgot. They rejected the knowledge found in God's way. Israel intentionally removed his wisdom that is found in the commandments, found in the statutes and the judgments with their enduring moral principles. And the same thing we see has happened today. You know, we have thrown God out of our classrooms, out of our courtrooms, out of our government, and out of the workplace. We've removed his commandments from places where law is supposed to be enforced. And in our information age, ironically, the world is suffering from a lack of knowledge or wisdom. And it will lead to our destruction, just as it did Israel and Judah. God told his people to live by his law, to make it the framework of the home, to teach it to their children, Deuteronomy 6:7. And this was done sporadically and only for relatively short periods of time. And therefore, as the prophecy says in verse 6, God would not bless their children any longer. For thousands of years they would not be blessed. Only a few, only a select few, because of Abraham's blessing. And so he would destroy the nation, he would forget them until the time of Christ's return. The same thing, but on a larger scale, is happening today. You see, America once had biblical values. They were a foundation for the establishment of this nation. But now we teach a multitude of beliefs and we create laws so that people can get around keeping the law. And there's utter confusion in the minds of young people today. Why, even just the other evening, I was asked by a young store clerk what I had done that day. He was just making conversation. And it was after sundown, and I had kept the Sabbath. And I told him I kept the Sabbath today. And he kind of gave me this blank stare, indicating, you know, he had no idea what I was talking about. You see, many young people today, they don't even know what the Sabbath is. They don't have no idea what the Ten Commandments are. And even most Protestant organizations that claim to be based on the Bible, they have little spiritual knowledge. Why, they just preach a lesser form of tolerance than the liberal left. They have idols. They keep pagan holidays. And they worship Christ on days where the goddess Ashtoreth is worshipped. Is it any wonder that God feels a need to tear down everything and to start all over again from scratch? You know, he's not going to attempt to save any government or any religion of men. It all has to be reestablished and founded on Christ. And so as the world population swells to a number never before seen, so have the sins of men dramatically increased, bloodshed upon bloodshed. The more they increased, the more they sinned against me. I will change their glory into shame. Why, they eat up the sin of my people. They set their heart on their iniquity. So the more people have, the more they feel like they don't need God. For example, America has prospered for decades until people finally began to think, well, we did it of our own. We, you know, our own ingenuity made this country great. You know, we used to credit God for our blessings, but now people relate it to chance, or many people even feel that we were never a great nation. And the values of the founding fathers were, many people see as being tainted by their regard for God and the Bible. Even many history books have tried to edit God out of our past. As one liberal woman said to me the other day, she said, you know, I've never been more proud to be an American and a non-Christian. And so we see this is the mentality of many. They think that America was never intended to be a nation under God. And this twisted value system that people are adopting, this is going to bring this nation down, just like it did Israel. And we see it beginning to take place today. As verse 7 indicates, their perceived glory was their pride, but it was shameful, and God would reveal the disgrace of their wickedness. And God said in verse 6 that he would reject them from being priests. And this means authority figures. People that were supposed to be role models for the people. But it came to a point for that even the leadership, who should have higher standards, they actually enjoyed the iniquity. They fed on it. And we see that happening throughout government today. Offerings that were given by the people in that time were made in shallow repentance, and it fed the priests who profited from the sin. As verse 8 indicates, they eat up the sin of my people. They set their heart on iniquity. And it reminds me kind of the health and wealth gospel that teaches, that preaches that people are always forgiven no matter what. You know, we don't need to keep the commandments. Just make sure you tithe and give your offerings, and the ministers get rich on this false gospel that condones sin. And it verse 9, it says, it shall be like people, like priest. So I will punish them for their ways and reward them for their deeds. The priests were no different than the people. They should have taught against sin, upheld the law, but they were just as corrupt, just like most leaders in this nation today. So God said it will be like people, like priests. They will both suffer the same fate. In verse 10, for they shall eat, but not have enough. They shall commit harlotry, but not increase, because they have ceased obeying the eternal. Harlotry, wine, and new wine enslave the heart. You know, the heart is the seat of our emotions. The people were passionate, but they were passionate about spiritual and physical harlotry. It had stolen their heart. They loved getting drunk on false doctrine. You know, like an alcoholic, it eventually enslaved them, and they wanted more, new wine, as it says. But the representation is not just spiritual. You know, the people literally participated in drunken orgies. There was widespread corruption, adultery, and fornication, including wine, and they looked forward to the next vintage of wine along with the next sexual encounters. And these encounters often corresponded to the pagan feasts that were held in honor of the Ashtoreths. So this kind of behavior became a passion for many, and it was condoned by the ideals of the false gods that they worshipped. In verse 12, my people ask for counsel from their wooden idols, and their staff informs them, or staff or stick, a piece of wood, for the spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray, and they have played the harlot against their God. So speaking again about this idolatry found in, you know, wooden idols, idols that were carved and shaped into whatever god it was that they were worshiping, the staff would be their counselor, or a piece of wood would be their counselor. And this, of course, is considered spiritual whoredom. And it reminds me of, in a way, of tarot cards, or tarot cards. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. But these are cards used by mediums that supposedly you could tell the future on. And they're just made of printed paper, or perhaps some use these glass globes. Now look into the globe and I'll tell you your future. But they are just wood and glass, and they have no spiritual value. They can give you no real advice. But the people came to trust in these idols instead of trusting in God, because, you know, they were spiritually and they were physically intoxicated. In verse 13, they offer sacrifices on the mountaintops and burn incense on the hills, under oaks and poplars and terebinths, which are different types of trees, because their shade is good. And therefore your daughters commit harlotry and your brides commit adultery. the preferred locations of worship of these pagan gods, that is, were among groves of trees or in the mountains or under branches of oaks and at the tops of hills. Many of these locations were not just for a cover of shade, but to hide their lewd and licentious conduct. Ashtoreth was one of the favorite idols. It's likely because she was a sensual fertility type of goddess that condoned adultery and fornication. And this fictional character became Astarte and Ishtar, Yaster and Easter. Her worship included the sexual activity of men with women who were ordained to be temple harlots, and even daughters and married women participated in the harlotry. In verse 14, "I will not punish your daughters when they commit harlotry, nor your brides when they commit adultery. For the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with a ritual harlot. Then therefore the people who do not understand will be trampled." Now this verse seems to be saying that God would not punish the daughters and the brides who were led astray by the men, but it then states that people who do not understand will fall. And we know that all of Israel was punished for their evil. God didn't spare the rod against those who followed in the footsteps of sin simply because they were taught to sin by others. And for these reasons, it seems to me that there's something lost in the translation. Instead of verse 14 stating that God would not punish the daughters who commit harlotry and the brides who commit adultery, instead, I think this is asking a question that has an obvious answer. And the question is this: will I not punish the daughters when they commit harlotry or your brides when they commit adultery? And then we have a comparison made in the rest of the verse between their activities and that of the temple harlots. And these were women who were trained in sexual activities. Now, the New King James Version adds the words "the men." It's in italics, meaning that it was not a part of the original text. And so the translators likely thought that these words referred to everything being the men's fault. And then they translated it to lean in that direction. But the daughters and the brides were not forced to go along with the harlotry. In other words, they were voluntarily participating in the same kind of activities that the men were doing with the harlots. So would God punish voluntary wickedness? Of course he would. Which is why at the end of verse 14, he said that even the people who do not understand how evil this is, meaning even those who do not discern between the unclean and the clean, these people will also be trampled. So God did not spare anyone for their sins. The whole nation was punished. It wasn't just the men. In verses 15 through 16, "Though you, Israel, play the harlot, let not Judah offend. Do not come up to Gilgal, nor go up to Beth-Aven, nor swear an oath, saying, 'As the Eternal lives.' For Israel is stubborn, like a stubborn calf, and now the Eternal will let them forage like a lamb in open country." So God was giving the house of Judah a warning, a heads up, if you will, in this prophecy, because the house of Israel had been playing the harlot for quite some time. But do not let the house of Judah follow that same path, is what he was saying. Learn from what God had declared and what you will see happen to your northern brothers when they fall by the sword of Assyria and they're taken away captive. And even though some might still say that the true God lives, well, they continue to disregard him. Don't say such a thing if you don't mean it, in other words. Jeremiah 5 and verse 2 says, "Even though they say, 'As the Eternal lives,' surely they swear falsely." And God told them, "Do not go up to Gilgal and Beth-Aven." Beth-Aven is the same as Bethel, where the tabernacle once stood, but it seems that the prophets changed the name from Bethel, because Bethel means house of God, to Beth-Aven, meaning house of vanity or house of iniquity. And the reason is because Jeroboam, who was the king of the northern kingdom after they divided, he had set up golden calves to be worshipped in this place. And this was so the people would not go down to worship at the temple in Jerusalem. Gilgal is a location on the border of the northern and southern kingdoms, and it seems that Gilgal also became a hub of idolatry, which would make sense, seeing that Jeroboam and the preceding kings of the house of Israel, they tried to stop the northern tribes from traveling to Jerusalem three times a year for the pilgrimage feasts, and they set up the golden calves, and they would have set up other places of worship where people would travel through between these two kingdoms. So God was warning Judah in verse 15, don't be stiff-necked like the stubborn house of Israel. And he compares them to a rebellious or backsliding calf that doesn't want to move in the direction that the master is leading. And then in verse 16, he makes another comparison, that the house of Israel would become like a lamb in an open country, meaning a lost sheep in a wild land, alone with no shepherd to guide and protect them. They would be helpless prey to predators, and the predators that would come is the brutal forces of Assyria. Well, up to this point, the house of Judah had maintained a level of decency. They were not entirely disconnected from God and his laws, as was the house of Israel. But their history, of course, was intimately connected to the northern tribes. And they too, the house of Judah, also had a tendency to allow false gods to dictate their morality. Considering that both nations allowed the surrounding people to infect and affect them, God gave the house of Judah a heads up. Don't follow that path. Don't go down the path of the northern tribes. This message stands true for God's people today. You see, we live in a world where most of us are in close proximity to immorality and idolatry on a daily basis. Even if you were not to leave your home, it's there when you turn on the radio, when you turn on the television, when you get on the internet. And it can have an effect on us if we do not keep our guard up. And so in this way, God is giving us a heads up. Do not simply claim that God lives, but conduct yourselves in a way that displays that God is living and that his laws are good and just and that people are required to live by those laws. As the world gets worse and the love of many grows cold, some behaviors that were considered horrible in the past are not considered very bad today. We live in a moral decline of Western civilization. Because we strive to maintain a level of purity, some Church of God members might begin to think that, well, we're still good, you know, as long as we're not as bad as those around us. And many are compromising and are giving in to lesser forms of iniquity because, you know, it's still better than the rest of the world, right? So the warning to the house of Judah, it's a warning to us as well. Don't go there. Don't lean in that direction. Draw a thick line between them and us, and do not allow for wiggle room so that we can maneuver around keeping God's law. And the warning continues in verse 17. Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Naming the tribe Ephraim is likely not speaking of the tribe exclusively, but it's likely a reference to the house of Israel in general. And the reason is because Jeroboam, their first king, who had set up the golden calves in Bethel and Dan, he was from the tribe of Ephraim. In addition to this, Samaria was located in the region of Ephraim, and Samaria was a chief city of that kingdom where many high places of worship were erected. So God is warning Judah, do not go there. Let them alone. Don't go in the direction that they did. In verse 18, their drink is rebellion. They commit harlotry continually. Her rulers dearly love dishonor. Now, this is poetic, if you will, but it's unappealing nonetheless. It's a description of their wickedness. You see, they enjoyed participating in rebellious and dishonorable acts. And so God had given them opportunities to repent and to change time and time again. But they continued to reject him. And they played the harlot. And now, in verse 19, the wind has wrapped her up in its wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. So God had symbolically brought Israel out of Egypt on the wings of a great eagle. And now they were going to be slaughtered like a helpless lamb, and the survivors would be wrapped up in the wings of the wind and taken away to faraway lands where the tribes would become lost to history. And so most of the northern tribes do not even know who they are to this day because of this prophetic judgment we find in the book of Hosea. And it's a horrific prophecy, but it was one that was written for us to learn from. Because if God's people today are not on guard, we could find ourselves in a similar situation. Our nation and much of this world is heading down the same path of spiritual harlotry. There is drunkenness and lewd behavior physically and spiritually. You know, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender movement has opened all kinds of doors of immorality that are now being taught to your children in school. We're killing hundreds of thousands of babies every year, never giving them a chance at life. We promote the worship of just about any false god one might choose, while alienating society from the biblical ethics that made this nation exceptional. Therefore, similar tragedies are going to occur in this land. America and most nations today are abandoning God, and God will abandon us. But you and I, we can escape what is coming if we do not let the sins of this world take us on its wings. The wicked are going to be destroyed and people are going to suffer horribly. But we can be saved. We can be taken to safety on the wings of a great angel as prophesied in Revelation in chapter 12. So next time, we'll hear more about the judgment of Israel and the impending judgment on the wicked of this age. But there is also a great hope for all of mankind when we go through chapters 5 and 6.